So, good morning. What we've been doing, we've been looking at this question of reverence, reverencing the other. And we took a look at the way Jesus did that with the woman at the well. And we saw there that, in a sense, he played hardball with her inauthenticity while reverencing her. We don't reverence like in the abstract. We reverence in the concrete. In the abstract, we could think of all kinds of nice things about the person, but concretely, there are two mixed bags, I guess you could say, me and the other person. Then yesterday we looked at the issue of how we see Jesus and wondered whether we're doing justice to the developmental manner of his coming to his own self-understanding. And if the suggestion was made, although that's depends on your own piety, the suggestion was made that if you only see him in the eventual fullness of what was understood about him, we could miss an absolutely major way of having an image of the reverence of the other that his low Christology gives us. Today I want to talk a little bit about the more frequent relations that we have, which are impersonal. Most of the people that we deal with, that we don't know on a personal basis. And so how to take this theme of the reverence of the other, the reverencing of the other, to that major number of relationships that we have, which are not personal. What are the insights about reverence that come from the world rather than from our faith? And should we join forces with those insights that come from the world rather than our faith about the dignity of the other? I think we should, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I liked Desmond Tutu's image of dealing with other people as if they weren't people. Is like spitting in the face of God. And he was saying that, he came out with that statement, you know who he is, an Anglican bishop who was extraordinary in his leadership along with Nelson Mandela in this whole matter of trying to break through the culture of apartheid that had held the black and brown community in virtual, I guess, slavery in South Africa. I was in South Africa last September giving talks at some of the universities there, and apartheid is finished as a system, but it's not finished as an economic reality. It's still kind of sad. And AIDS isn't helping it. There's only been one time in our history as human beings, one time, that we agreed upon a formula, a universally agreed upon moral formula. And that was in 1948. And the moral formula that we agreed upon was to be a human being means that I can make a claim on you, whoever you are, about certain things in me that I need, and vice versa, you can make a claim on me about certain things that you need. And that particular idea had been fomenting for several centuries, the 18th century largely. And the idea was human rights. The idea came paradoxically. As a result of the exhaustion of Catholics killing Protestants and Protestants killing Catholics in the religious wars, and in that exhaustion, to reduce history to simplicities, the Enlightenment was born. And the Enlightenment was basically saying, trust rationality. And from the trust of rationality, this idea of what is our relationship to one another, and morally what is called for in this relationship we have with one another. And the people like John Locke and a number of philosophers began to develop the idea of human rights, which are moral claims that we have interdependently, one on the other. And that idea of human rights developed in the 18th century in the direction of civil political rights. So they were called negative rights. Insofar as I am self-determining and we are self-determining, we have immunity from your coercion of us, civil political rights. And then in the 19th century, a second generation of rights was born called socioeconomic rights. And socioeconomic rights basically say that I need certain material conditions in order for my flourishing to take place. I need food. I need shelter. I need clothing. We need food. We need shelter. We need clothing. And the assumption is that the conditions, the social conditions, are such that you can procure those for yourselves. But if you can't, then the idea of socioeconomic rights kicks in, and the supply of those material necessities must come from outside of you, namely from another person or from another organization or from your government. Then the 20th century, a third generation of rights were born, cultural and indigenous. And cultural rights were basically, as the Summer Institute of Mount Angel Abbey, we've developed this little culture. And with this culture comes our need to be free to do what we can in order to have our group become what we want it to be and continue as we want it to be. John Paul has been a major figure in the articulation of cultural and indigenous rights. I don't know if you know the story of Dorothy Stang, SND, was killed about a year, maybe 2 years ago, Notre Dame de la Mort nun, who had committed her life for something like 28 years for the cultural rights of the Indian tribes in the Amazon. And the Indian tribes in the Amazon were losing their cultures to the loggers. And she went all the way to the top of the Brazilian government denouncing the loggers, not only for the ecological damage to the Amazon, but also for the fact that these tribes were being decimated because site or land was essential to the continuation of the tribe's self-understanding or identity. So here you get this first unanimously agreed upon moral category of human rights. Where did it come from as a formal declaration? It came from the horrors 150 million people had slaughtered, or 150 million people were slaughtered in the first half of the 20th century. And kind of the whole world rose up and said, no, how can we stop this? We had two world wars and the Holocaust and the hydrogen, the atomic bomb, followed by new moments in the development of mass weaponry. How can we stop this thing? And it was somewhat like the cry that came from the Hebrews when their rights were violated. God intervened, and so we had the Exodus, and then we had Israel. I think it's not pious to think this way, that God intervened when the cry came from humanity, we got to stop this slaughter of one another. And when there was finally VJ Day and VE Day, the idea of a United Nations was born, and with the birth of the United Nations in 1945, you had the first decision made. We've got to write a moral document saying that it's immoral to violate human dignity. And Eleanor Roosevelt was put in as the chair of that, the writing of that 1945. If you want to read a really thrilling little book, A World Made New, it's called A World Made New, by Mary Ann Glendon. Mary Ann Glendon is a very devout Roman Catholic teaching at Harvard Law School. And it's the story of the development of the Declaration of Human Rights over between 1945 and 1948 when it was approved. It's a great book because it gives you all of the humanity of something that ends up abstract, the Declaration of Human Rights, but it gives you all the arguments. It's a remarkable 4 years. And 10 days after this universal Declaration of Human Rights, the first moral document ever written by the human race, agreed upon by the nations, 10 days after the signing of the nations to that, the Iron Curtain fell. And when the Iron Curtain fell, something interesting happened to human rights. The U.S. Proclaimed its moral superiority over the Soviet Union because we really believe in civil political rights, the first generation rights. We really believe in the people having the voice to determine their government and all the particulars of their government. The Soviet Union began to proclaim its righteousness because you don't find beggars on the streets of Moscow. In other words, we believe in the material conditions people need for their dignity. So we understand human rights, and we are an instance of a country that observes human rights. So no sooner had this thing been signed, an extraordinary leap forward in human history on the reverence for people, than it was politicized. And it was politicized for this reason, that in the course of the 4 years when they were trying to confect this document, and they had Jacques Maritain was one of them, they had a fellow from China, I forget his name. There were basically six people who were at the core of the authorship of this thing from different cultures and from different moral understandings, systems of moral understanding. They agreed almost within the first year of doing this, 1947 and 46. We can't, let's be realistic about this. Let's see if we can assert what the rights are without having to get into the anthropology or the philosophy or the foundations of why there are these rights. Because we're in such a critical situation in the human race, we've got to assert these rights. But the foundations and who's responsible for these rights, let's leave that to some subsequent UN conference. So you had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was to be followed in some unnamed year, the Universal Declaration of Human Responsibilities. That conference never has taken place. The second time the UN decided to gather the world together to talk about human dignity, the reverence for one another, if you will, in terms of human rights, was 1993 in Vienna. And I got to that conference. And it was an amazing conference. In this huge hall, there were 178 nations represented with all of their delegations. They were upstairs in the assembly hall. And then downstairs were 800, at the minimum, 800 NGOs, non-governmental organizations, all of whom had been approved to come and set up little booths. to proclaim or to promote or to advance or to explain the particular rights that were being violated in their area of the world. It was very interesting. I found a back stairs which was had a door open, so I was able to, I wasn't supposed to be upstairs, but I snuck upstairs to see the rationality and the maneuvering of the delegations, and downstairs the unbelievable passion about human rights. There were seven nations upstairs saying that human rights is a construct from the West, and so we reject this as a construct from the West because it's a cultural thing, and we're not Western, we're Eastern. And in all cases, those seven nations were told by their leadership, don't buy human rights because it threatens the power of the throne or of the faith or of whatever the power is. We can't afford to have people making moral claims that they should be free and immune to develop their sense of what is necessary for their humanity. The first generation of rights are called negative rights. So it's an issue. I don't ask you to do anything except give me the freedom, give us the freedom to determine our lives. And the second generation of rights, the socioeconomic, are called positive rights because action is called for. My people are starving, so action is called for. Who is responsible to take the action that is called for? So here you have this terrific concept, which is basically a major advance in human history, that we interdepend on one another. We interdepend on one another. And that there's no such thing as human flourishing without this interdependence on one another being positively owned by action or negatively owned by him. I stay away from saying who you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to, excuse me, understand yourself. Now, this question of the church and human rights, there's an ambiguity here. The church fought the idea of human rights because they saw the French Revolution, boom. And what was the French Revolution about? It was throwing the church the hell out of determining who we are. So the killing of priests and nuns and the burning of churches and all that stuff. So the institutional church dreaded the notion of human rights and basically marched under the flag of error has no rights. So this 1948 declaration in a sense awakened the church to go back to the question of human rights and ask, what are we to make of it? As you know, the moment that that human rights got out of people's minds and into a constitution was with all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, Jefferson, Declaration of Independence. So at that point, it got out of a concept and into a constitution, and from that constitution to now something like 140 constitutions, human beings have rights. So reverencing one another, because you can make a moral claim on me, and I can make a moral claim on you, that there are certain things about me that you have to reverence and certain things about you that I have to reverence. And we're going to agree on this in order to live with some peace with one another in the world. So two people in one event changed the church on this. The one person who was a professor of mine and a dear friend of mine, Father John Courtney Murray, I had him for 3 years when I was a student theologian at Woodstock College in Maryland. Woodstock used to be a place where Jesuits studied. Now it's a research center at Georgetown, where I am, where we study and write stuff. Good stuff, by the way, good stuff. So Murray was a real tall guy, and he had polio when he was a kid, but he didn't have it so bad that it crippled him. So when he would walk, he walked like a prince, because he had a bad leg, basically. And everything about him was enormously dignified, because he had a great brain, but he also had a very tender side. And we used to have picnics. We had this, 400-acre place in Maryland, and we would invite him to picnics with us, maybe 10, 20 of us. And we'd come home from these picnics. I remember the physical sensation of my brain, the edges of my brain being blown apart. Because just the conversation that you'd have with this guy, man, where does he get all this stuff, But what we was thinking about most of the time was the American experience of freedom. That's what he was thinking about. And since he was taught in Europe, did his doctorate at the Gregorian in Rome, he was able to say, well, the American experience in this whole matter of human rights, for example, or freedom, is very different than the European experience. And he started to write out the difference, and the difference got him silenced. But he didn't... He didn't stop his mind, although he stopped some of the publications. And little by little, his mind was taken seriously by the American hierarchy. So then when Vatican II came, Cardinal Spellman said, Father Murray, I want you to be a paritus, an expert, to come with me to the council. So Murray said, fine. And then the Vatican said, you can't have Murray come to the council. So Cardinal Spellman, knowing how to play hardball, said, he doesn't come, I don't come. The Vatican says, of course, bring him. Murray was a major actor in writing out the document Dignitatis Humanae, or the dignity of human beings, that the council approved with almost no dissenting votes. So 2,500 signatories from the bishops basically saying, this is a very interesting document. It's saying that people have the freedom to determine their religion. See, so this is a real move beyond error has no rights. So if you're in doctrinal error, but this is a move beyond that, and it's a major move beyond that. It didn't go the next step, because it couldn't at that time, but it will. If people have the freedom to determine their faith or to determine not to have faith, they should be free to do that. It didn't go the next step, which we'll have to do, which is, what kind of freedom do you have within the faith that you've determined to follow? Anyway, that's down the line. That's an agenda still to be done. I say two people and one event. The second person was little old John Paul, not John Paul, John the 23rd. Roly-poly John the 23rd wrote this encyclical in 1963 before the council voted on this stuff called Pachymenteris. And he did something interesting in that encyclical. Not only did he incorporate what the UN had done, he incorporated the panoply of human rights with some minor exceptions, but he also said that the basis, the anthropological basis for this, the foundation for this, is in the human being from God. Now notice, Jefferson said, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. That's a religious statement. But John went a step further and said, you know, these immunities and these claims must be observed if the human being is to be reverenced and if the human being is to be pleasing to God. He went a step further, and he basically said that the endowments that human beings have in their intelligence and in their reasoning are sufficient warrant for those claims to be elicited and observed. To put it in the technical language, the way the church talks about this stuff, there's a natural law basis for human rights. They don't come from legislation. They don't come from other human beings. They come from the way God has scripted the mind and the heart. It's called a natural law basis. So we're not going to have, if we were to follow this, a UN Declaration of Human Responsibilities, because the responsibilities come out of right reason being rightly used. They come out of right reason being rightly used. Has the Proclamation of Human Rights worked? Yes and no. And you know this as well as I do. Yes. Sharansky and a number of people in the Soviet Union under the Iron Fist imprisoned created the Helsinki Watch. And the Helsinki Watch was in contact with the U.S. And the Helsinki Watch grew as a force from within the Soviet Union. And the Solidarność in Poland with Lech Walesa, with the assist of now a pope who's Polish, created Solidarity. And Solidarity was a union in Gdańsk, Poland, that created a consciousness in all of Poland that said, basta to this crap we're under. So you had human dignity emerging out of totalitarian, hegemonic, cruel, brutal handling of human beings, both in Poland, the Velvet Revolution led by Vaclav Havel and the Theater of the Absurd. Funny ways these things go. And Czechoslovakia, and the Soviet Union, with the people starting to say the emperor has no clothes, the Kremlin has no clothes, and you had a largely bloodless revolution because of human rights in the world. And you had the South African revolution against apartheid under the claim and banner of human rights. And you had the civil rights revolution in this country, which was also largely bloodless. But it helped when a whole country saw little black kids with the dogs sicking them, blown down the street by the fire hoses. And then the whole country said, this is wrong. I guess my emotion comes because I've got involved in that stuff. I was teaching at Georgetown at the time, and anyway, that's just personal. So it worked. In other words, this moral force coming from within people that says no, under the articulation of this no, objectified in terms of human rights, it works. Up to a point. Up to a point. The first reason why it's weak is because it's not clear who's responsible. In other words, the situation in Darfur is clearly a violation of human rights. Who's responsible? So there's a weakness intrinsic to the doctrine of human rights. The moral claim a response is necessary, either a response of immunity, negative rights, or a response of action, positive rights. But who's responsible? Well, the government's responsible. The government's responsible. Well, where does that leave me? It leaves me just marching off on my own agenda. Or the government's not responsible, in which case we have the faith-claimed religious organizations and stuff like that. So there's a weakness in this matter of responsibility. The second weakness is who proclaims, in other words, who proclaims these rights? Who proclaims these rights? And technically, the proclamation of the rights should come from within the conscience of the persons who claim to have them and the consciences of the persons who claim to respond to them. But then we have the judicial system. And the judicial system takes human rights, they come from our humanity, claims coming from our humanity, and makes them legal rights. So it gives them the force of law. Now, what would happen if a judicial system claimed a legal right to something that wasn't a right. Then you get cheap talk rights. Then you get rights rooted in talk rather than in humanity. So in 1965, the Supreme Court in this country had a case called the Griswold case. And in order to decide this case, they talked about the right to privacy. And they didn't explain what the right to privacy was. They just said, well, it's people have the right to be private. And then in 1972, in the famous, still highly contentious Roe v. Wade decision, the right to privacy meant the right to say that the life in my womb doesn't have a right, but I have a right to choose. So you had the right to privacy in 65 get legs into the right to abort. And then in Casey in 92, you had this mega right. Let me just read you this mega right. Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, one's own concept of meaning, one's own concept of the universe, and one's own concept of the mystery of human right, life. That's a mega right. So the weakness of human rights is coming in through the judiciary. And the judiciary is based on a jurisprudence, which I would call a jurisimprudence, which says that the way you know the law is through precedent. Okay, so I'm an attorney, so I've got to know what the precedents are, and I sure do know have to know what the precedents are. But the precedents are always laws. Is there a higher law, or is there an objective moral order that even the precedents have to respond to? So it's like a lot of specializations. The judiciary is in a specialization which is legal. The result is a legal positivism. And a legal positivism basically means that if we say it's a law, if we say this right is a law, that makes it a right. If we say this right is a law, that makes it a right. The church says, if you say this right is a law, that doesn't necessarily make it a human right. So this is the impasse we're at. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, if you think about the history of Roman Catholicism all the way up to and present to today, with our three sisters sitting here, makes me think of it. The church has been simply extraordinary throughout history in responding to the socioeconomic needs of people. Father Gaffney, a guy from the Chicago province, Jesuit, had his throat cut maybe 6 years ago in Kathmandu. Gaffney was the social welfare epicenter in all of Kathmandu, where he had been for years. All he did was create institutions to respond to human needs. And he created one institution after another, after another, after another. And then he realized that from the king's own palace, there's a drug trade being developed here. And I'm starting to see it, and I'm starting to name it, and I'm going to do it, and he had a throat cut. And the police said he had his throat cut because he was in a homosexual liaison with the guy who cut his throat. Everybody in Kathmandu knew that was nonsense. And by the hundreds of thousands came out to march in his funeral procession. Anyway, the interesting thing about Roman Catholicism, as indeed many of the churches, they've been observing rites for centuries and heroically, but very seldom under the banner of rites. The other interesting thing about our faith is that the basis for human rights is best articulated in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So although it didn't have the articulation of human rights, it had the fact that human dignity was what the prophets were always yelling about. It would be better that Jerusalem be destroyed than that human beings be violated. What they were saying. Or Jerusalem has been destroyed because human beings have been violated, and God will not take the violation of the people that he's made into his own image and likeness. And it's kind of a test case for the point. Let me just give you one text. The purpose of reading this parable, we're kind of losing altitude here. So before we crash, you know the parable, and you know that the one man was called Dives, and he chose to ignore Lazarus, and the parable is about how Jesus sees his indifference to Lazarus. He sees it in major terms. You know the parable. The point of the parable is to say about the force of a document or a statement about the violation of human rights versus the force of something like this that you start to internalize. Who is the Lazarus at my gate when I finished eating my full? The dogs are coming to lick his sores, and he died, and the way... So it's if you will, it's an eschatological look at indifference to human need. And it's a major statement about human need. So the value of the scriptures versus that which elicits fairly little energy documents of human rights elicit fairly little energy. Versus a document taken to be revelation elicits enormous energy, because it forces the question, is there a Lazarus at my gate? And why is that important? Because the Lazarus at my gate, in the case of Dives, was meant to be a sacrament, which if Dives had availed himself of the sacrament, he would have been rocking in the bosom of Abraham too. He chose not to avail himself of the sacrament that was the poor man at his gate. And he ended up at a place where there was a chasm, unbridgeable, between my side and your side. So this is a parable from the lips of Jesus about human rights and about their import, not just about equality of opportunity and socioeconomic rights now, but the import of this, the eternal import of this. And that's just one document, one parable, with both the prophets in the Old Testament and Jesus in the New Testament saying, take the moral claim of another very seriously, because God does. Because the person making the moral claim may well be the source of your own salvation. That's when you take this universal document or universal doctrine of human rights and you bring it into a very forcible issue. How does God see the person in need? And what is the relationship between the person in need and, in fact, my own salvation? Okay. Between us and you, Abraham says, there's a great chasm that prevents anyone from crossing who might wish to go from our side to your side and your side to our side. So we've matured into the 21st century with a way of reverencing one another through human rights. That is a major, major moment in history, but it has its weaknesses. Those weaknesses can be met by Scripture. Before I die, I would like to get the idea of canonization. Who gets canonized and who gets beatified? I'd like to get, so why don't you all join me in this and we'll march on the Vatican. Although the Vatican is a lot more benign than you think. If you spend any time with it, it's just like us, just a group of folks trying to do their best. And they're just people. The institutional church is us people. Not some big ogre somewhere. But anyway, let's march anyway. And let's say that it would be good if the beatification and canonization of saints began to be looked at in terms of what did they do about human rights, civil, political, socioeconomic, cultural, indigenous. So I would like to canonize Dorothy Stang tomorrow as an instance of a person who gave her life for a people's cultural rights. etc., etc. Be a different way of looking at canonization. But it would join the forces that are concerned about human dignity, and it would join those forces the world over and get some muscle into this important doctrine. So, would you go with me? Four minutes for questions, if we're to observe the time.
Is there a good book on Dorothy's Stand?
Pardon?
Is there a good book on Dorothy's Stand?
I think not yet, because she just died, and she was murdered by the loggers, and they've caught a couple of the they caught the loggers who murdered her, but they haven't caught the logissimo, the person who sent them. I just made that word up. I don't know if that's what you're
saying. There's some good web stuff on Dorothy's death.
Pardon?
There's some good articles on the web on her death.
On her death, okay, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's some of them I read through some fairly major Catholic web. Stories.
Yeah, good. STANG. And she asked to be buried. Well, the other interesting thing about her, if my memory is correct, when she saw them coming at her with the gun, she had her little Bible. She opened her Bible to "Blessed are the peacemakers." She was reading that to them because the people who were caught said what she was reading to them, and right through her head. And she has to be buried right at the same place where she died. The people there knew that. And immediately the Brazilian government, you know, within 5 days said, "We're going to stop the loggers." They haven't.
Yeah, I like to think that we're progressing. You know, keep that as far as recognizing human dignity and noticing better. Then, just about to address, we talked about it a little bit one-on-one, just culturally, the indifference we have to brutality.
Right.
You turn on the evening TV, every image you get is a human body filleted.
Right.
People stand over and say, "How did they die?" Yeah. And it's interesting, and I wanted to address that, and if you had addressed kind of the cultural antagonism with the whole Iraqi situation, like, how do you see that in there?
The same way you do. The same way you do. Were you the one, somebody I talked to, talking about the food we take in, we become what we eat? The food we take in, we become what we eat. The data that we take in, we become what our consciousness receives. And when our consciousness receives brutality after brutality, we become neighbor numb. And when we become neighbor numb, then the only thing that will elicit any energy is something right before my face that's real, that doesn't come through virtual reality. I think virtual reality, some of us have talked about this at lunch and dinner. Is the glory and the bane of our lives right now. Carol Corgan is an extraordinary teacher at Gonzaga High School, and she said each year the freshmen who come into freshman year are more and more withdrawn from me because the iPod, the text messaging, the internet, it's like, who the hell are you to tell me what's going on? I know what's going on. I can access anything in the world. To live in virtual reality, the only thing we can get out of move from virtual reality is to the virtue of solidarity. The virtue of solidarity is John Paul's great statement about it's the ability to have compassion for each and all. And he got that out of, not out of his head, he got it out of Solidarność, out of solidarity movement. It works. If we get together, it works, and we overthrow all this nonsense. So somebody said it, somebody here said it, I thought it was wonderful, that if what we become is what we eat, what we take in is what we think. So what are we taking in? What are we allowing our children to take into their consciousness? It's frightening what they can see. It's frightening what they can see now, which they never saw before. And you can't police it all the way to the end. There has to be something proactive about human dignity, which is why we're having this conference. We have to be proactive about human dignity. And there's no other way to do it that I know. Yes?
I'm kind of trying to sort out to what you said in terms of seeing relationships in the light of my faith, loving my neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, up to now, I think...
Can you hear her? Yeah, why don't you, could you stand, because you have so much to say. You said a lot, yes, and turn to them. You said it yesterday.
All of my thinking has been more on loving one another, more than in the big context of human rights. Or,
right.
And I think a lot of it is based on my faith, mm-hmm. and the fact that this world is in a state. We're trying to get it right, and heaven is when it will be right. So ours is to try, but I also know that I have friends who see this world as it.
Is it?
And it has to be right now.
Right.
So, and I think a lot of the human rights come from this wanting to create fairness and equality right here, right now.
Now, right. Good. This is the third time I've talked to this woman and her husband, who's... Can I say that? Had his baptismal birthday, 19th baptismal birthday yesterday. Yeah. You put your finger on the issue, as usual. The battle is between secular fundamentalism, which basically says what we make of it here and now, as best we can, is it. That's secular fundamentalism versus the natural law tradition that most every faith was in until the Catholic faith ended up holding the bag on natural law, which is basically saying you make your judgments about right and wrong on the basis of something that transcends the here and now. So you have a secular fundamentalism that does not have a transcendent, and you have a natural law moving people to say this is wrong because there's something in me that knows there's something more than here and now. That's the key battle going on in the world. Secular fundamentalism always knows that you can't go to faith because it only just gets us mad and gets us in trouble and gets us arguing, and it's all private anyway, and you can't prove anything. That's secular fundamentalism. And the other understanding, which is right and wrong have a here and now component, and right and wrong have a now, an after, thereafter component, which is right, why I gave you this. This is the thereafter component to human rights. The chasm. In other words, human rights would create a we here, and God wants a we here. But the sanction for creating the we here is the communion of saints, the beyond, the eternal we. That's the sanction. But at the same by the same token, it's important for us to not ignore human rights because of the weaknesses in that doctrine, but to promote human rights, to defend human rights, to stand with people who are for human rights, people who are not even believers. Sure.
It's not an end in itself, but part of a bigger.
Good, good. Human rights are not an end in itself, but part of a bigger. See, we get all the way from Sri Lanka, we get enough sense into our American culture here. Thank you, Keith. One last point, though, has to do with secular Jews that I've lived with in New York, Washington, Charlotte, and Chicago. The secular Jews that I have lived with in those four cities are the strongest advocates for human rights. What do you make of that? And one of the things you can make of it is that we can be so full of faith that we transcendentalize what our relationships ought to become and stay with those that we're most comfortable with because of our faith. That's not our faith. That's not our faith. Our faith has to do with this guy at the door. This rich man was dressed in purple garments and fine linen and dined sumptuously every day. Did not let in the reality of Lazarus. And so no action was taken because he didn't let him in to his mind and his heart and his choices. So part of our faith says that the great beyond will be where or will be made up of people that we've made we's with. Whether we've done it because of human rights or just out of our basic compassion for one another. Anyway, glory be to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.